This past week, on December 7th, we marked an anniversary, kind of an infamous anniversary. It would be the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I don't know that anybody here is old enough to remember that. I don't remember it. Of course, I wasn't born yet at that time, but we marked that anniversary this past week. And it is certainly, for those who do remember it, who experienced it, was something that they recall where they were, what they were doing at the time when they heard the news about it. Of course, it changed the course of events in the war going on at that time. I found an article that I found quite interesting entitled The Warrior Class. And it was about the young men who entered West Point in 1939. It was a class of 700 plus. And I thought I'd read a few excerpts from the article because it speaks to something that we'll get into in just a little bit here. They are the boys of the class of 1939, the class the big wars fell on, World War II, Korean War, Vietnamese War. The charter members of the greatest generation, a label we've come to give that generation of soldiers and men and women who grew up at that time, who were young men, young adults, young people, the greatest generation. They were the young princes, it says, of World War II. Many were colonels before they were aged 30. Today, their hair, what's left of it, is gray. Backs that were ramrod straight in troop assemblies on dusty parade grounds are bent now. Legs that marched through the hedgerows of Normandy and the jungles of Bataan now are no longer trustworthy. The boys, even the youngest now, are in their 80s and 90s, and of course they're dying at about 1,000 a day. 1,000 World War II veterans die each day. But don't think of them as old. Think rather of lions in winter. It goes on to say, back in the summer of 1935, over 700 of the boys marched up the hill from the train station at West Point. So 700, 1935, entered West Point. 4 years later, having survived the hazing, the hassles, and the academic grind, 456 cadets graduated. So those 700 plus 456 made it. West Point, goes on to say, one of them comments, West Point is a special place, and every graduating class has its share of heroes and visionaries. The class of 39 is special, though, for the impact its members had on the military, molding, shaping, and leading us through World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. The reason our class had an impact, says retired General Walter Kerwin, who served as Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, is because we came in 1939, got our feet on the ground, and moved into key positions. We had a substantial impact by having gone through three wars. We as individuals did not change things, but we as a class, moving up the line, made substantial changes. 72 members of that class became generals in the Army and the Air Force. An additional 224 rose to the rank of colonel. Many served for 30 years or more. My father served in World War II. He was in the second wave of the D-Day invasion. And as most, it seems, of those who served in World War II have been, he also was reluctant to share experiences and to talk much about what he experienced, what he saw, and what he witnessed and participated in the years he was in Europe fighting there through Germany and France. But when you look at the history of our country, and we call these group the greatest generation, when you look at the history of our country, you find that each generation, it seems, has a unique and strong motivating factor, something unique about that generation that shapes and, in a sense, I use the word loosely, programs, in quote, programs them in a certain direction, in a certain set of, to have a certain set of values, perhaps a certain gut reaction to the situations they faced. And you can go back through history just as these who went through West Point and then World War II, and then later on Korea and Vietnam, imbibed certain values, developed certain values and standards. You can look at each generation, each decade, going back many decades, and studies have shown that many of these values And programming happens in the first about 10 years of life, when a young person is 7, 8, 9, 10, up to about 10, that they can be programmed in a certain direction depending on what's going on in history around them. For example, those who were very young in the 1920s, after World War I, which at that time was the greatest war, were in a sense programmed, again using that word loosely, to become and to be super patriots. To be super patriots. In the 1930s, young people were looking for a program to look for security. Security was important because their families were going through the Great Depression. Many had lost jobs. They didn't have much. And so here were young people growing up at that time. Security was very important to them. I know my own parents were that way. In the 1940s, young people, in a sense, studies have shown, were programmed or came to be spoiled by parents who now had money to spend and did not want their children to miss out on the things they missed out on. And so they now had more affluence. The Depression had passed, the war was over, and they now could provide things that they missed out on. In the 1950s, affluence and television developed an age of computerized, they called it computerized or television babysitting. And in many ways, in our country, what was going on then began to contribute to destroying family life in America, as young people were programmed to be more attuned to those things, television and what was going on, and the images and visions they could see for the first time. The 1960s, experiment with lifestyles, experiment with many different lifestyles and drugs and those things that were going on becoming quite popular in the 60s. Many young people went in that direction. The 1970s, it became an era of challenging established authority, even more so than in the 60s, to challenge established authority in the aftermath of Vietnam, Watergate, some of those things, a skepticism about authority, about those in charge, about leadership. In the 1980s, young people could be, and many were, programmed to seek a narcissistic lifestyle. That is, to indulge themselves, to make mine while the getting was good. We refer to the birth of the yuppie generation at that time, or the dink couples, double income, no kids, who were more focused on money and earning as much as they could and not have children, a very narcissistic lifestyle. In the 90s, this was the 90s, anything goes, is almost the way it was, and much more so in the direction of, what's right for you, well, that's right for you, but that's not for me. There was much more of a loosening of values and standards. People were reluctant to say somebody else's beliefs or standards were better than anyone else's. They're all good. If that works for you, fine. If this works for me, fine. Let's not judge one another. And so the 90s created a great deal of that. Just different alternate lifestyles. The alternate lifestyle philosophy came to be very popular during that time. Now we're in the 2000s and the 2010s, etc. We have a time of instant communication. And at the same time that, we see economic decline in our own country and other countries of the world. But this matter of instant communication and the challenges in building healthy relationships as a result of that, that so many have faced, and our young people are going through that, and in a sense being programmed by those conditions at this time. Would you say, I certainly would, that the pace has quickened, it seems. The pace of change of these kinds of things, and it seems that societies and people go through crises relevant to their lifestyle, to their development, instead of once every decade, that has sped up, where every 3 or 4 or 5 years, it seems, we're going through new crises and challenges of building healthy relationships and healthy attitudes and lifestyles. The pace just continues to speed up. And so I ask the question for us in the church, what are those stabilizing factors? How do we continue to deal with the rapid change in society? When I look back at my father-in-law, who died at age 95 a few years ago, and of course, things that we did, with computers, with communication, were incomprehensible to him. He didn't grow up in that as those things developed, it was not part of his lifestyle. He grew up on a farm in South Dakota, and farmed all of his life. And yet there were certain stabilizing things in his life as a member of God's church. Likewise for us. You know, what are those things? What about for our children? There are things that, you know, my children and teens today, you know, grab onto so quickly, and it comes to this, you know, the rapid change in communication and electronic technology, and that, you know, I struggle with. And I was mentioning before services just to do certain things, you know, with webcasting, and I've got to prepare myself a cheat sheet so that I can follow written instructions, because it just doesn't come to mind as quick. It's not something I've just done all the time. I can do it, but I, you know, make sure that I'm following the step-by-step instructions that I've written down. Our young people, most of them aren't that way. You know, they've embraced rapid change. But what are the stabilizing factors in the middle of all of that, in the middle of the rapid pace? As parents in today's society, it's easy to get frantic about keeping up with the knowledge explosion, making sure that our children are positioned for a future, for an education. I was talking with my brother who recently moved to Boca Raton, Florida. He and his wife met a couple down there just as they were sitting in the park with their little girl. My brother's the one who's now 61 and has a little year-and-a-half-year-old little girl. His wife is 45, I think, and, you know, this was a surprise to them, but now they're parents at an advanced age. So they do all the things that new parents do, taking their little girl to the park and taking her to the beach, and they've got to pull at their home, so they spend a lot of time in that. But they were talking with another couple, a young couple, younger couple, who had two children, one in school, one about to go into school. And this young couple was paying $24,000 a year in tuition for a private elementary school. The little one is like in second grade, first or second or third grade, you know, and they're paying $24,000 a year for that. And their younger one is going to enter school in about 2 years, at which time they plan to pay $48,000 a year. And they're both working so many long hours that they're paying $1,200 a month for daycare services. So $1,200 a month, $14,000 for daycare, plus $48,000 for two kids in this elementary school. And you know, how much difference does it make at elementary school level? But apparently these parents are very concerned about positioning their children and for their future and their education. So, you know, it seems this pace of change and frantically trying to keep up, you know, it does affect us. It has impact on us. It does on our children. And so what will people look back at, you know, 40 years from now and say, well, in the 2010s, young people were programmed to, you know, what? Something to think about in light of what we see happening. There is a perspective from the Scriptures that I believe can help us to stay balanced in an age of rapid change. And it has to do with the story of three daughters. I don't have three daughters, I have two daughters, two sons. But this is a story about three daughters. The first daughter was considered strikingly beautiful in appearance. Very strikingly beautiful, very attractive, very alluring. The second daughter was not ugly by any means, but in a sense a little more plain by comparison than her strikingly beautiful sister. And the third daughter robed herself, kind of covered herself in flowing gowns and veils to conceal her beauty. Few really knew her or what she was like. So it's a story about three daughters. Let's go back to Genesis 3. We were there a little bit ago and introduced the first daughter. Genesis chapter 3. The daughter that everybody wanted, that was because of her beauty and allure, she was attractive to many. And we read about her in Genesis chapter 3. We'll review again some of those scriptures that we heard just a little bit ago, beginning in verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the tree of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, and you shall, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Notice back in Genesis 2, verse 9. Out of the ground the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Adam and Eve, we understand, ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They were seduced, you might say they were allured by this first daughter, who is the daughter whose name is knowledge. Her name is knowledge. Very desirable. She is desirable. People spend years, money, a great deal to acquire her, to acquire knowledge. You have, to some degree, I have in my life, tried to acquire certain knowledge. I think of that couple that my brother met, you know, spending $48,000 a year in a couple of years so that their children acquire certain knowledge. People pursue knowledge. It is attractive. The first daughter, strikingly beautiful, very attractive and alluring, and people spend years, much money to acquire her. She appears to be very beautiful, and she is, but there can be problems with this daughter. Did you know that the sum total of man's knowledge could be represented, if it were represented graphically, it could be represented this way, up to 1845, from the beginning of man's history to 1845, if the sum total of man's knowledge at that point is represented by 1 inch on a vertical graph, then from 1845 to 1945, it would be represented by a 3-inch bar. From 1945 to 1976, it would be the height of the Washington Monument. From 1945 to 1976, from 1 inch to 3 inch, you know, to 1976, the height of the Washington Monument. And that's where the calculations that I was reading stop. From 1976 to 2011, what would it be? Mount Everest? It'll be certainly much, much higher. We understand that knowledge is exploding. Knowledge continues to explode. And one stat I read said that more than 2,000 pages a minute of knowledge today, every day, 2,000 pages a minute, so fast that even Einstein couldn't keep up. This article said that if you read 24 hours a day from age 21 to age 70, so read, do nothing but read 24 hours a day from age 21 to age 70 and retain all that you read, you would be at least 1.5 million years behind when you finished because of the rapid pace of knowledge and how rapidly knowledge is exploding. Be 1.5 million years behind if that's all you did from age 21 to age 70. There is so much that is being produced and written, so much knowledge. The explosion is incredible. And we have greater access to knowledge today than ever before. With all the with the internet and all that's at our fingertips, we have so much knowledge available. Let's go to Proverbs 3, verse 20 for a moment. Think about this first sister of knowledge, this first daughter, the daughter of knowledge. Very beautiful, but there can be problems. Proverbs 3, verse 20, an interesting statement about God and power in God's knowledge, where we read, "By his knowledge, by God's knowledge, the depths were broken up and clouds dropped down the dew." By his knowledge. There's certainly power in God's knowledge. There is limitless power in God's knowledge, but there is power in knowledge. Knowledge can be powerful. And it's one of the things that makes it so attractive and alluring. Knowledge can be powerful. But there can also be problems with it as well. Proverbs 24, verse 5. Proverbs 24 and verse 5. We're told that a wise man is strong. Yes, a man of knowledge increases strength. A man of knowledge increases strength. So knowledge is necessary. We all have to have a certain amount of knowledge and all different kinds of knowledge, scientific knowledge, business knowledge, money knowledge, music knowledge. Some people have a tremendous knowledge about, you know, human relationships. They have almost a sense that makes them very good at it. There's certainly knowledge of the Bible, knowledge of God. There's all kinds of knowledge. And we're simply told here that a man of knowledge increases strength. But again, there are problems in having just knowledge. In Proverbs 12 and verse 1, Proverbs chapter 12, verse 1, and these principles are very important for our young people to understand, as well as all of us, but it becomes vital, especially as we face the days ahead and what we are seeing happening in history and in the world in news now. Proverbs 12, verse 1, whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid, the New King James says. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge. It is good. It can be good to love knowledge, to want to be taught, to want to learn and be instructed, but some don't handle it very well because they don't want correction. They don't seek instruction. I'm reading a book right now about the Fab Five. Anybody know who the Fab Five was? The Michigan basketball team, the greatest probably class that was ever recruited, incoming freshmen included Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Ray Jackson, Jimmy King. The three of them were considered the best players at their position in high school in the nation. And two of them were in the top 100 players in the country, and they were all recruited, all came to the same freshman class to Michigan, whatever year it was, 1990-something. And finally, partway in that season, the coach, Steve Fisher, started all five freshmen, which was unheard of. You didn't start five freshmen in a big program like Michigan, but he did. They were so good, he started all five of them. And they, sure enough, did go to the NCAA championship final, the final game they played against Duke, whom they had lost earlier in the season. I won't tell you how that turned out, you may remember. It was quite a game. And in their second year, they also went to the NCAA final, during which Chris Webber, who was considered the best player in the country, made a serious mistake in that game that ended up costing them the game. But it was interesting that the personality of one of them, Jalen Rose, very, very talented young man playing basketball, but did not really take to instruction kindly. He was pretty much a free spirit and had a great deal of influence on the other players as a result. And there was all this constant struggle and pull and push between him and the coach. And as a result, they lost games they should never have lost because of, you know, just thinking they were the greatest, especially Jalen Rose. And they lost important games at times, you know, teams that they never should have lost, but they had so much talent. The team they should have lost to, they beat. You know, they kind of rose to the occasion, but there was a reluctance to really take instruction and to take correction. Some of those five did. But Jalen Rose had the biggest problem with that. And so we're told it's good to love knowledge, but you know, some don't want to be taught and be instructed, and they gain knowledge but don't handle it very well. And again, you think of how that applies, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in our nation today, in our culture today, in our among our children, and teens and young adults. There are some applications that are very important. Proverbs 15, verse 14. Proverbs 15, verse 14 tells us, the heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. We're told it's a good thing to seek knowledge. It is beautiful. It is desirable to seek knowledge to prepare for the future by getting some form of education, technical school, formal education in a degree program, certainly the knowledge of God, knowledge of the Scriptures. There's certain knowledge that is good to seek. But let's notice Proverbs 18, verse 15. What's the problem with knowledge? Proverbs 18, verse 15. We're told here that the heart of the prudent acquires knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. The heart of the prudent seeks knowledge. To seek knowledge alone, without the other attributes that we'll talk about in a little bit, the other daughters, that knowledge can lose its beauty. We've all seen that, the child who knows more than the parents, or thinks he knows more than his parents. The employee who knows more than his employer, you know, in everything, and conducts himself that way. The student who knows more than the teacher, and that's the way, that's what his attitude is. Or the player who knows more than his coach. And the example that I was just giving, there are, we've all seen those kind of problems. That word prudence, not being prudent, is an interesting word. Prudence means the ability to govern and discipline oneself by the use of reason. Thinking correctly, the ability to govern and discipline oneself. Prudence also can mean discretion or foresightedness. Seeing down the road, if I continue in this way, here's what's going to happen. If I continue in this way, here's what's going to happen. And making wise choices, given a certain body of knowledge. Just as with any beautiful woman, or I guess say man as well, but in the case of three daughters we're talking about, just as with any beautiful woman, a movie star, Marilyn Monroe, although she didn't live long enough to have it happen to her, Elizabeth Taylor, others who died recently, the day comes when much of her physical beauty is gone. Much of that physical beauty is gone. It fades away. And the allure is gone, despite help from whoever, Avon and, you know, whatever, Clairol and, you know, Breck and all, no matter what we do as human beings. The time comes when that beauty goes and leaves, physical beauty, and she loses her allure. Likewise, with knowledge alone, it's important to come to realize that knowledge is not everything. There is much more than just having a lot of knowledge, just as there is much more to being a Christian than having the knowledge of Christianity. Much more to being a Christian than just having knowledge of the Scriptures. I heard a very wise minister many years ago one time talk about some people are converted to knowledge. That is, it's the knowledge, their interest in the Scriptures that grabs them, that begins them, helps them to begin to walk down a certain path, but they never become converted in heart and mind. They become converted to knowledge. The knowledge is fascinating. It's interesting. As you know, Christianity and being a Christian is much more than just having knowledge. It's important to have the other sisters as well. There was an interesting story in a National Geographic issue a few years ago about a young man who decided he was going to leave America. He said he was fed up with our system of government. He said he was fed up with our tax structure, etc. It's got a whole list of things. Said that he just was fed up with about the United States of America and that he was going to leave and live in some other country. But a friend of his convinced him that before he did that, he should travel all over the country and visit all parts of America, visit small towns, visit people, visit all different parts of America. And so he agreed he would do that and took about a year to do that. And as he did, as he walked across the country and began to meet people and experience different aspects of life that he had never experienced before, he began to gain some experience that went along with his knowledge. He changed his mind, ended up not leaving the United States based on what he began to experience. Let's go back to Hosea chapter 4. Hosea 4. We heard some interesting comments in the sermonette about the importance of confidence. Notice what Hosea 4 has to say about one of the biggest problems in our nation today. Hosea chapter 4. It is the fruit of what is listed here. Hosea chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. For the Lord brings a charge, or literally a legal complaint. Is what the word means. God brings a complaint, or a legal complaint, against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint with bloodshed upon bloodshed. Therefore the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away. With the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea will be taken away. Now let no man contend or rebuke another, for your people are like those who contend with the priest. Therefore you shall stumble in the day, the prophet shall stumble with you in the night, and I will destroy your mother. Interesting statement. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. I will also reject you from being priest for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. What it's describing is a condition that has gotten to this point that there is no confidence anymore, as we heard in the sermon, no confidence in this case, no confidence in leadership, no confidence in the prophets, the religious leaders, no confidence in parents, I will destroy your mother, you know, no confidence in the leaders of the nation, the government leaders. And I look around us today and we see a situation in which the Democrats have no confidence in the Republicans. Republicans have no confidence in the Democrats. People don't have confidence in either one, you know, as far as the general populace, although they take sides. No one seems to have solutions to the most pressing problems of our nation today, of our nation of Israel, a breakdown of character, a breakdown of families, economic problems, crime problems. No one seems to have confidence that anybody can do anything about those things. And God says here in verse 4 that there comes a time when it's useless to continue rebuking because it just does no good. And that's what he's telling us there in verse 4. It just is useless. He says we have all kinds of knowledge, all kinds of technical knowledge and scientific knowledge and communication knowledge and, you know, instant communication, this digital age in which we live and, you know, all the things that are available to us. We have all of that knowledge, but we're lacking the other two daughters as a nation, as a people. We understand that real knowledge begins with the law of God, but that's been cast off in our country and in much of the world today. Proverbs 1, verse 22. There can be a problem with knowledge only. Knowledge is desirable, it's good, but there can be a problem with it. Proverbs 1, verse 22. Notice the statement here where it says, "How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge." Foolish people, it says, hate knowledge, the lack of true knowledge. When a person doesn't have true knowledge, the knowledge of God's law, the knowledge of God's way, what do they end up looking for? They're looking for fulfillment. They're looking for answers to life. They're looking for, you know, all kinds of things that they end up being frustrated about, or continually looking for excitement or some new gadget or something new that is going to make their life whole or make their life complete. With the lack of true knowledge, always looking for something else to fill life and having a very, very difficult time, an impossible time doing so to their satisfaction. Verse 23, notice how God describes this frame of mind. He says, "Turn at my rebuke, surely I will pour out my spirit on you, I will make my words known to you. Because I have called and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel and would have none of my rebuke." God offers knowledge, God offers true knowledge. He calls some who are called simply refuse to respond to that. "I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your terror comes, when your terror comes like a storm and your destruction comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you." You know, the fate of a people who have only knowledge and not even true knowledge. "Then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me because they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord, did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of my counsel and despised my every rebuke. Therefore they shall eat the fruit of their own way and be filled to the full with their own fancies." Interesting statement. Filled to the full with their own fancies. Black Friday, people filled themselves with a lot of fancies, didn't they? You know, it was one of the stations in Milwaukee did an interview of just had people call in. You know, invited people to call in about their Black Friday shopping experience. And the purpose that this particular commentator had was to find out, because people say that, well, they shop Black Friday, they can get all their Christmas shopping done and, you know, buy things for everybody on their list and get it all done in one day. And so he asked them about, well, what did you buy? And then who did you buy it for? Turned out about 80% of what, at least those who called in, were buying for themselves. They weren't buying for, you know, get Christmas gifts, but they were buying things for themselves because, oh, I like this, and television, whatever. They were buying for themselves. And, you know, nothing wrong certainly with buying for yourself, but it kind of shot a hole in the idea that while we're doing our Christmas shopping for everybody else, they may have been doing some of that, but mainly buying for themselves. I just thought it an interesting statement in verse 31, to be filled to the full with their own fancies. Certainly live in an age and a country where that is possible. For the turning away of the simple will slay them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will dwell safely and will be secure without fear of evil. So there is more to life than knowledge. God says there does come a point of no return. People who have been on the verge or have heard God's truth, however rejected it, perhaps in the second resurrection they'll have their opportunity. But knowledge alone is not enough. Knowledge alone simply is not enough. There are problems with it. That leads us to the second daughter. This second daughter that needs to be there along with knowledge. She has a certain natural beauty. She doesn't have the same allure, the same instant attractiveness as the first daughter. But there are some enduring qualities about her that add to her beauty. Certain qualities like strength, discernment, timing that she has. She helps impart certain judgment and enables a person to use that knowledge to make right decisions. She has a lot to do with how knowledge is applied. How knowledge is applied. What to say or do, when to say it or do it. The timing may be important. How to say or do a thing. She may have knowledge. We may have knowledge about something, but, who do we share that with? Maybe, we've got to be careful. Maybe this isn't the right person to share it with, but this one is. Or when we share the knowledge, or when we, talk about a certain thing. All of that has to do with this second daughter. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Notice the statement here. Very important statement that is vital that we as parents teach our children, that our young people learn as they mature, as they grow, that we be sure that we have learned lessons related to this principle. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 1 through 5. Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? Man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. This second daughter we're introducing is the daughter of wisdom. Wisdom that can change, it says, the sternness of a face. I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the word of the king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful, and a wise man's heart, notice this, a wise person's heart discerns both time and judgment. Discerns both time and judgment. Understands, knows both time and judgment. A lot of people may know what to do in a situation, but to know when and how comes through wisdom, how we apply that knowledge. There's a certain wisdom. Time and judgment is involved. In Ecclesiastes 9, verse 13, where does that come from? Let's read on. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 13. Solomon wrote, this wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. It doesn't seem to be natural and normal for people to laud and praise those who exercise wisdom. People are lauded and praised for having a lot of knowledge, the doctorates of this world, and they certainly have a lot of knowledge. One definition I heard of this was said in jest when I was in college in Cleveland about a particular professor who was the world's expert in a particular type of snail. That was his, he had a doctorate and he was the world's, he taught comparative anatomy, and he was the world's expert of a particular type of snail at John Carroll University. Maybe you've heard the definition, if I can remember it, of a, you know, of someone who pursues that kind of knowledge, who learns more and more about less and less until he knows practically everything about almost nothing. And that's kind of the way that it seems knowledge, and then to be the foremost, you know, in his field, you know, people laud that. But to laud people who exercise wisdom and to praise people who exercise wisdom is rare. They look for the person with charisma or with, you know, a great deal of knowledge or who will smooth things, well, you know, in a sense, lie to them, schmooze them and say smooth things rather than what, you know, people need to hear. It goes on in Ecclesiastes 9, verse 16. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised. Seems the way it is today. And his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. The person who's always out in front shouting and gathering attention may not be the wisest person. It's an important lesson, again, that we teach our children, our young people, you know, the value of wisdom, even though it may get criticized or ridiculed at times or made fun of. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good. I mentioned the Fab Five from Michigan. Chris Webber was considered the best high school basketball player in the country. In college, he was considered the best college basketball player. Jalen Rose was not far behind. They both came from an inner city, one from Chicago, one from Detroit. And although Chris Webber was the dominant player in almost every game he played, Jalen Rose was really the leader. And far too often, Chris Webber would follow what Jalen Rose came up with, some brain-haired idea, you know, some wild-haired idea to do something different or, you know, that got them in trouble at times. And for whatever reason, Chris Webber would just kind of fall in line and do whatever Jalen Rose wanted him to do. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. When Israel sought a king, God gave them exactly what they asked for. And what did they ask for? Remember, they asked for a king who was powerful in appearance, who towered over them, somebody who looked regal, somebody who looked like a king. And certainly Saul was an impressive looking person. You know, he towered over everybody. He was, you know, had tremendous in his appearance and physical presence. But in times of crisis, as time went on in his life, what happened? It seemed like he withered. And he got smaller and smaller. And the wise person, you know, is often forgotten. People tend to look to the one with glamour or charisma who is also willing to take the credit. And Saul was more that way. And as his life went on and he got further away from God, he had less and less wisdom. In Ecclesiastes 10, verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. Begins with foolishness and gets worse from there. A fool also multiplies words, a caution about somebody who just has a lot to say and never stops talking and just overwhelms, you know, reason with a multitude of words. A fool also multiplies words. Verse 14, no man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. There is a wearying effect. They weary of really doing and applying knowledge in a righteous way. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 11. Notice this statement. The words of the wise are like goads. What is a goad? It's a poker. You know, it pokes, it stirs, it gets you moving. So the words of the wise are like goads that can spur to action or push us. And the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. Why does he use that statement, well-driven nails? You can put a lot of nails in something you're building, but unless you put them in the right place, the building you know, it's just going to come down. It's not going to hold together. It's just worthless. You can put a lot of nails in something, but unless you put it in the right place, all you've done is to no avail. Well-driven nails. How to use knowledge. Wisdom has a lot to do with how we use the knowledge we have. And so a young person with less experience in life, who may have a lot more knowledge about a certain thing than mom or dad, you know, still needs to be careful how they're going to use that knowledge and seek advice and seek counsel and go to someone older with who also has the experience so that the knowledge they have can be like well-driven nails. It's a valuable lesson in life. Verse 12 and 13 adds to that, "Further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh." It's not an excuse for not doing homework, but it is an excuse, you know, for just endless learning and acquiring knowledge. And I know a relative who, that's all this person does, acquires knowledge, goes to school endlessly. Couldn't really, I don't know that she could support herself, take care of herself, but, you know, endlessly going to school, you know, and just, that's all she seems to be doing. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. "Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." How to use knowledge, a matter of wisdom. And then 1 Corinthians 2. 1 Corinthians 2 is, well, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 1 and start. 1 Corinthians 1, notice the discussion here in verse 18 about wisdom. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18, "For the message of the cross, Christ's sacrifice and death, is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." Okay, so there are those who consider, you know, what we feel is important to be foolishness. "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?" It's a vital principle, again, for us to understand, for our young people to understand. There's a foolishness about the wisdom of this world. There are good things in this world, and there is knowledge we need to acquire, and we need to prepare for a future. But we also have to realize there is an inherent foolishness in the wisdom of this world when it leaves out God in God's way, and yet decisions are based on knowledge only instead of the wisdom of God. "For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe." What seemed to be a foolish message, a simple message, you know, of faith in God, belief in the sacrifice of Christ, you know, Paul is referring to it, to some they call that foolishness. Verse 22, "For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. To those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men, for you see your calling, brethren. Not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, noble, or called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty." Well, again, it's not just a matter of knowledge. Now, there is this matter of wisdom as well. Notice the next chapter, verse 6. "However, we speak wisdom among those who are mature." What matures us? Experience is one of the things that mature us. Certainly trials, difficulties, trials in this life have a purpose. One of those purposes is to mature us, to become more mature in mind and thinking. It takes a certain amount of experience. It takes trials. And sometimes a young person who has never experienced those things or who has not had gone through that maturing process has a lot of knowledge, but the wisdom is lacking because they haven't come to a mature frame of mind yet. They don't really understand because they haven't experienced certain things. God's Word certainly can help us prepare, mature to a degree, but it's how we live it and how we apply it and how we put it into practice, how we stay faithful to it in the face of trials and tests. All of that is important and part of that maturing process. Verse 7, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew, for had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Verse 9, but as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. So there is knowledge that comes from God, and there is wisdom that comes from applying that knowledge, putting it to work, and living it in our lives, and all of that adds to our wisdom. Mark Twain once said this about experience and wisdom. He said, we should be careful to get out of an experience only the wisdom that is in it, and stop there, lest we be like the cat that sits down on a hot stove lid. She will never again sit on a hot stove lid, and that is well, but neither will she ever sit down on a cold stove lid. Won't ever again sit on either one. And there is, you know, certain wisdom that comes from experience, but the Word of God helps us rightly divide, you know, knowledge, man's knowledge, God's wisdom, man's wisdom, so we discern, you know, what to gain, what to glean out of our trials, what to gain out of an experience we have with the Word of God and the help of the Word of God. This leads us then to the third daughter. The third daughter who supports her two sisters, but to a degree she hides herself. She's known by those who have knowledge and wisdom. And she comes, again, also to a degree by experience, both joys and tragedies. That scripture, Romans 8:28, about all things work together. The joys, the tragedies, God weaves that all together. And to introduce us to this third daughter, Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs 1, and notice verse 7. We're told that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and instruction. So there is a place where true knowledge begins, and this has to be the foundation of all of our knowledge. The fear of God, respect for God, respect for God's Word. That's the foundation, the healthy foundation of all knowledge. Let's go back up to verse 5. A wise man will hear and increase learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma, the words of the wise and their riddles. A man of understanding, it says. The third daughter, whose name is understanding. Knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. A man of understanding will attain wise counsel, will seek, will acquire wise counsel, will recognize where to go to for good advice and sound counsel. Will understand a proverb and an enigma, something that can be puzzling to many people, something that people just don't understand why such and such is happening, why the world is going the way it is, why, you know, how a life can be happy. You know, to that, to many people, that those things are enigmas. And a person of understanding will understand the words of the wise and their riddles. Understanding helps us make sense out of things that to many people simply don't make sense. They have a lot of knowledge. Sometimes they even apply it correctly and have a certain amount of wisdom. But in putting it all together, and then, okay, how do I apply this in my life? Where is this taking me in life? What is the ultimate goal? And how do I get there? Certainly understanding it is required. Notice verse 20 and 21. Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open square. She cries out in the chief concourses at the openings of the gates in the city. She speaks her words. Here, statements about wisdom. And in every age, for example, you know, in every age we know that God has called many people who have chosen not to listen. And you know, they'll have an opportunity later, but there is certain wisdom that calls out, that cries out. Now let's read on here in verse 24. We've read some of these before. Because I have called you and you refused, I have stretched out my hand and no one regarded. Because you disdained all my counsel, would have none of my rebuke. Notice verse 29. Because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would have none of my counsel, despise my every rebuke. Notice the opposite of a person of understanding who does not seek wise counsel, who does not understand the enigmas and riddles of life, who rejects fear of God and who rejects God's law. They hated knowledge. They hated fear of God. They didn't have a respect for God. They didn't understand. They couldn't put together knowledge and wisdom, couldn't combine both of those, and ended up in a sad circumstance. Douglas MacArthur, one of the most interesting books I ever read a long time ago, is a book entitled Reminiscences by Douglas MacArthur. It's an autobiography, of course, of his life. And he relates this experience. And it was a strategy he carried throughout his years in West Point, and it stood him in good stead. He writes, the first section, a group of students, was studying the time-space relationship, later formulated by Einstein as his theory of relativity. So, studying the theory of relativity. The text was complex, and being unable to comprehend it, I committed the pages to memory, MacArthur says. When I was called upon to recite, I solemnly reeled off almost word for word what the book said. Our instructor, Colonel Feiberger, looked at me somewhat quizzically and asked, do you understand this theory? It was a bad moment for me, but I did not hesitate in replying, no, sir. You could have heard a pin drop. I braced myself and waited. And then the slow words of the professor, neither do I, Mr. MacArthur. Section dismissed. Nobody understood it. They had the words, and Douglas MacArthur, in his book Reminiscences, said that he determined that he was, of course, it was part of the honor code, to tell the truth, to not lie, to do all that he could, to do his best, but that he would tell the truth when faced with, you know, those kind of circumstances. He said, nope, I don't understand. You know, and it's something in human nature, especially, and again, not just young people, we're all this way. We're reluctant to admit sometimes that I don't understand a thing. I don't understand the problem in school, the writing assignment, the math problem, the technical aspect of how to fix or do or, you know, make this work. And sometimes it comes down to what's happening in our lives where the fruits may not be good, and it's clear we don't have understanding, but we're reluctant to admit it. We're reluctant to say, well, you know, I don't understand how I got to this point. This is not where I want to be in my life, or my marriage, or my child rearing, or my finance, or whatever. And at times we find ourselves reluctant to say, I don't understand. Help me to gain understanding in this, and to seek it. So we're told there, you know, a man of understanding will attain wise counsel, verse 5, Proverbs 1:5. Why? To understand an enigma, a mystery in life, something that he's obviously struggling, he or she's struggling in life, but no, they don't understand. The words of the wise, to understand those things, seeking understanding, putting the knowledge together with wisdom. God's word imparts certain wisdom, but we also have to seek understanding. Proverbs 2, verses 1 through 8. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. There is a diligent application of the whole person. The heart has to do with a person's mind and emotion, his whole life. It has to do more with your life. Applying your life to understanding. Yes, if you cry out for discernment, to be able to discern the way a thing is, the attitude, the spirit of a thing, and with that discernment, have the foresight, the foreknowledge to say, I'm not going to go that way. I'm going to make this choice. And lift up your voice for understanding. If you seek her as silver, search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives you wisdom. All of that, you know, will be available to you. The Lord gives you wisdom from His mouth. From His mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. Again, wisdom comes with living, how we live our lives in an upright way, a certain lifestyle, applying the right knowledge we have, what we do with it. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk uprightly. He guards the paths of justice and preserves the way of His saints. That's an interesting promise from God. He preserves the way of His saints. All in the context of understanding and seeking understanding. We have seen times of trouble in our nation. We're in troublesome time right now to some degree. We see troubled times in the world. I don't know if you've been following, Guy alluded to it, but I just cut out a series of several articles that were in the newspaper recently about the euro in danger and what's going on in Europe. Listen to some of these quotes. I found these astounding. Just the you know, this is not somebody writing in a religious newspaper or a prophecy newsletter or something like this, from the Associated Press, out of Brussels, out of Paris. And it's talking about an article, with the euro in danger, Europe races for a solution. This was about a week and a half ago or so. One proposal gaining prominence would have countries cede some control over their budgets to a central European authority. In a measure of how rapidly the peril has grown, that idea would have been unthinkable even 3 months ago. The nation would cede more of their own control of their budget to a central European authority. That idea is growing in popularity. Now, have you heard anything in prophecy that says this might happen? You know, I think back, way back, you know, to Mr. Armstrong, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, when Europe was in ruin and Germany was desolate, and he said, Europe will rise again, and Germany will be at the head, and here's what's going to happen. And listen to some of these statements. Allowing a central European authority to have some control over the budgets of sovereign nations would create a fiscal union in Europe in addition to the monetary union of the 17 countries that share the euro currency. So 17 countries currently share the euro. Some analysts have said that would be a leap toward creating a United States of Europe. More delicately, it would force the nations of Europe to swallow their national pride, cede some sovereignty, and agree to strengthen ties with their neighbors, rather than fleeing the Euro Union during the crisis. So all to draw European nations together. Is there a crisis going on? What if they collapse? There are some important meetings in Brussels this past week that just ended the other day. Listen to some of these statements. The European Union rose from the ashes of World War II, a conflagration that pitted the continent's great powers against each other and left scars on the land and the mind alike. And from the start, the question was whether this unique experiment in goodwill would ever become a United States of Europe, where cooperation ranked ahead of nationalism. Now, again, there's challenges, there's pulls to keep this from happening, and, you know, it's not all smooth, it's not been smooth, and it's not there yet. Now the time for the decision is at hand. And it's talking in those terms. Another man who said, we also consider the situation as grave, even as dangerous. And it referring to the debt crisis in Europe. And I found this statement most interesting from the Polish foreign minister. He said, I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say so, but here it is. Radek Sikorski said in Berlin this week, 72 years after German troops invaded his country, he said, I fear German power less than I am beginning to fear German inactivity. The biggest threat to the security and prosperity of Poland would be the collapse of the Eurozone. He said, I want to see Germany take the lead. I want to see Germany be active. I want to see Germany, the strong man, you know, go to work to prevent this collapse of the Euro. An article entitled, Europeans Face Historic Choice, Unite or Divide. Europe weighs unity to save the euro. Again, the article goes on in this vein, some amazing statements. Of course, we know that Great Britain chose not to be supportive. They did not support the pact, the agreement that has been, well, it hasn't been signed yet. Diplomats have to take it back to their countries and in their own countries ratify. All of this to say, you know, there are some serious times ahead. You know, for our nation on the world scene, prophecy is going to be fulfilled. We don't know exactly the direction or when any of these things are going to happen. There's times of trouble in our nation, in our world, that the Bible prophesies that are really going to happen. We've seen times of trouble in the church. Satan keeps working and trying to cause trouble that way. We know that we're headed for a time of greater trouble and even deeper problems in the months and years ahead. How do we sustain ourselves and our families through all of those? Through those troubles ahead, through the rapid pace of change. How do we maintain a certain constant? It does take and will require knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. It will take all three. God provides those through His Spirit for those who live uprightly, for those who seek those things. God makes that available. But we have to be humble enough to admit we need knowledge, wisdom, understanding, that we need all of that. In Proverbs 2, verse 9, notice the statements here. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity in every good path. When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you, understanding will keep you. That's for all ages, at any time in history, times of crisis, times of rapid pace of change that we just can't quite seem to keep up with. Still, there is knowledge and wisdom and understanding that will keep us to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness. Then it describes all the things that knowledge, wisdom, understanding can help deliver us from in the following verses. Verse 20, so you may walk in the way of goodness, keep to the paths of righteousness, for the upright will dwell in the land, and the blameless will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the earth, and the unfaithful will be uprooted from it. We need all three. We need knowledge, we need wisdom, we need understanding. It starts with the law of God, and it goes on from there. Proverbs 3. Do a little survey of some things in Proverbs here. Proverbs 3, verse 13. Happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. For her proceeds are better than the profits of silver and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things that you may desire cannot compare with her. Length of days is in her right hand, in her left hand riches and honor. Certain blessings that come with these things. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. All her paths are peace. In chapter 4, notice verse 1. Hear, my children, the instruction of a father, and give attention to no understanding. Verse 5. Get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Verse 7. Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, and in all you're getting, get understanding. All tied together. Verse 10. Hear, my son, and receive my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. Some interesting statements about knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. And then Proverbs 7, verse 1 through 4. My son, keep my words, treasure my commands. Keep my commands and live in my law as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. So here is knowledge. Notice the way it's described, God's words, His commands, His law, all of these things make up knowledge that comes from the Word of God. Verse 4, say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin. Here it talks about all three, being married to knowledge, or being bound to knowledge, bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. being married to knowledge or bound to knowledge, having wisdom as your sister, and it says understanding as your nearest kin. We need all three. Again, this is why it is so important that, you know, in our homes and our families and our congregations, that that there is a respect, that the young have respect for, you know, the older ones as far as seeking wisdom, that, and that only comes when, you know, when there's a natural relationship built, you know, where it's important as mothers, fathers, grandfathers, uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, for example, in any congregation or in any family, that, you know, we really do seek to get to know one another, that the older ones seek to get to know the younger ones, and the younger ones get to seek the older ones, so there can be, you know, some conversation. And there are just, it seems we live in an age and in the pace of life, as rapidly as it is, that, you know, that there's almost a reluctance to, you know, to seek advice from somebody older. Well, what do they know? They don't either. They're not tech savvy. And so, you know, I have all this I can do, but, you know, seeking advice, seeking knowledge, seeking understanding, you know, across generations, not just knowledge. Having just knowledge is not enough. Having all the technical knowledge and being savvy about what can be done is not enough. We need to have more than that. We need all three. Proverbs 9, verse 1. Proverbs 9, verse 1. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her meat. She has mixed her wine. She has also furnished her table. She has sent out her maidens. She cries out from the highest places in the city. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. As for him who lacks understanding, she says to him, come eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Forsake foolishness and live and go in the way of understanding. There is a way that leads to understanding, a way of life outlined throughout the Bible, throughout the scripture. There is a way of life that leads to understanding. There's a way of life that takes us away from understanding. And there are various degrees in between. Some stay close to a degree to that way of life, of God's way. Others get further and further away. Others stay right on. All different degrees. There is a way that leads to understanding, a way of life. If we have fear of God and respect for His laws and His knowledge, well then, you know, we can more effectively negotiate, navigate that way. There is a way. Proverbs 9, verse 10 and 11. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Notice how these are all tied together. Seeking knowledge, courting wisdom, getting understanding. Knowledge of God plus fear of God. So knowledge plus fear of God in how we live, how we conduct ourselves, which is wisdom. All of this then produces understanding. And we can say, well, I read it, I know what the words are, and now I've tried it, and I've lived it. Now I understand. Now I understand. I believe the young generation of today and the next generation, depending on how long time goes on, we don't know how much time there is in this age, but I think the young generation of today and the next generation, I believe, face an even greater test of standards, morals, values, absolute truths, things that influence them the most now, as in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 80s and the 90s, and all certain things that influence a certain generation. And as Satan gets even more determined and more frantic about the end of the age, he's doing his work even, you know, overtime to influence young people, to influence the young of today. We as parents, as a church family, it is important to set an example of knowledge, of wisdom, of understanding, of seeking those things, so that our young people can see the importance and understand the value of that. So the gist of this message is the importance of seeking to be well acquainted with these three daughters, the daughters of knowledge, of wisdom, and of understanding.